Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Happy January from HP. Save up to 65% during the Back to Business sale at HP.com. Live through January 14th. Shop online or work with our U.S.-based SMB sales experts to equip your business with the latest technology to drive speed and growth in 2023. Click on the link below or call 1-800-608-MYHP. Save an extra 17% on most business products by using promo code HPBusiness17. Exclusions apply. Act now.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, theater director Felix Barrett.
The idea of theatrical danger, it's a safe space to be frightened.
Felix shares the story of creating the immersive theatrical experience Sleep No More.
Whether they enjoy it or not, you certainly feel alive.
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
All episodes of My Indian Life seasons 1 to 3 are available to binge in full right now. That's Kalki Presents My Indian Life from the BBC World Service. Just search for My Indian Life wherever you found this podcast.
This is a global news podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 14th of January, these are our main stories. A New York judge has fined Donald Trump's family business $1.6 million for tax fraud. Russia says its forces have captured the Ukrainian town of Soledar, but Ukraine says the fighting there is continuing. The rebel Oromo Liberation Army in Ethiopia says it's carried out an attack on a prison that the authorities say led to the freeing of 480 inmates. Also in this podcast...
You peel back the wrapper, maybe you breathe in the aroma. Then you take a bite. You get your chocolate hit.
Scientists get their teeth into why we love chocolate so much. Could their research make it healthier? Donald Trump's business empire, the Trump Organization, has been given the maximum fine possible for a tax fraud scheme that goes back at least a decade. But the fine of $1.6 million is relatively small for a company that has an annual revenue of hundreds of millions. While neither the former president nor any of his family were charged, the Trump Organization now has a criminal record. Our North America business correspondent, Samira Hussein, told us more.
For years, some of these top executives at the Trump Organization were getting off-the-book benefits like cars and rent-free apartments and even just cash. And all of it was used as a method to avoid paying taxes. Now, part of this conviction and this penalty came from testimony from the Trump Organization's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, who was actually sentenced earlier this week to 5 months in jail for his role in that exact same scheme. But it was his testimony that really also led to a lot of the felony charges that were levied against these two subsidiaries of the Trump Organization.
And some might say that given this size of the company, the scale of the fraud, this fine is just a drop in the ocean. What does it mean for Mr. Trump, not just financially, but also for his presidential ambitions?
You're absolutely right. I mean, everyone has been saying, well, look, you know, $1.6 million is a drop in the bucket for the Trump Organization. They can easily afford this. And even the judge accepts that. But it's the maximum that the New York law would allow. And it also has, it's also certainly much less than the amount that the company should have paid in taxes. Now, the thing is, of course, yes, the former president may not have been charged himself, but the corporation that bears his name and with which he made his wealth now has a criminal record. Remember, Mr. Trump has already said that he would like to put his name in the ring for the 2024 nomination for president. And right now, since he's the only candidate, Republican candidate, that has voiced their desire to run on the ticket, then that really pretty much means he's a presumptive nominee.
Samira Hussein. The Brazilian Justice Minister, Flavio Dino, has said he will request the extradition of his predecessor from the United States if he doesn't turn himself over to police by Monday. Anderson Torres, who denies any wrongdoing, has been accused of complicity with thousands of opposition protesters who vandalized the presidential palace, Congress and Supreme Court on Sunday. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
The violence was carried out by supporters of the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who still refused to accept defeat in October's election. After leaving Mr. Bolsonaro's government in December, Anderson Torres was appointed public security secretary for the capital, Brasilia. He traveled to Florida on holiday soon after and wasn't in the city when the shocking scenes of vandalism happened. A Supreme Court judge ordered his arrest earlier this week. Mr. Bolsonaro is also in Florida, but the two men deny meeting in the U.S. and orchestrating the violence from there.
Leonardo Rocha. If true, it would be Russia's first victory in Ukraine for months after a string of humiliating losses. 2 days after the founder of the Russian mercenary force, Wagner, said his men had captured the small salt mining town of Soledar in eastern Ukraine, Russia's defense ministry is now making the same claim, although it's conceding that the Wagner mercenaries are the ones conducting the fierce street-to-street fighting. On Friday, Igor Konashenkov, the Russian Defense Ministry spokesman, made the announcement.
On the evening of January 12th, the liberation of the city of Soledar was completed, which is important for the continuation of successful offensive operations in the Donetsk region.
Both the Wagner and Russian government claims have been rejected by the Ukrainians, who say fighting is still continuing in Soledar. What is clear is that both sides have lost hundreds of men in the battle for this tiny town and its larger neighbour, Bakhmut. So why has Russia thrown so many of its forces into taking Soledar, a town which had a population of just 10,000 before the war? Our defence correspondent is Jonathan Beale.
There have been huge losses. Men have been thrown at the front to make these gains. Lots of lives lost on both sides. It's not going to change the course of the war, and it may be a Pyrrhic victory.
So given that, for what purpose is Russia committing so much manpower, so much of its weaponry to Soledar and Bakhmut, which is also a relatively small city? It had a population of 70,000 before the war.
Well, I mean, you know, looking at the wider way the war's gone, there have been gains by Ukraine over sort of spring, summer, when they carried an offensive in Kharkiv and then managed to push into Luhansk province. But Russia's goal has always been to control the Donbass, and they are territories that Putin has now declared as part of Russia, yet they still don't control those areas. And I think there's also a desperation to change the narrative of the war, which has been Russia on the retreat. And they need something that says, actually, here we're making gains. Not just for their own propaganda purposes, but for morale of their own forces too. What a Ukrainian commander told me when they, you know, when they had these sort of incidents, and it happened, remember, in Lysychansk, in Severodonetsk, where Russians threw lots of forces to take those cities, Ukraine eventually pulled out. The Ukrainian commander said, what we do is we just wear them down, wear them out. So, you know, for Russia, they've got to have the equipment, the manpower to continue an offensive. And the question is, have they used that up? Are they able to take Bakhmut next? Clearly, both sides are looking to the spring to resume offensive operations larger.
Because when spring comes, Ukraine is succeeding in its goal of getting heavy weaponry from the West. So could that really change the rhythm of this war? Because right now, it's been very slow, attritional fighting. Could that change? And that might be why Russia is so desperate for a victory before spring.
Yes, I think it's true that, you know, we've seen this slow crossing of a line for NATO countries that started, we're only giving you defensive weapons, and those were essentially shoulder-launched anti-tank weapons and anti-aircraft weapons. And then over the summer period, HIMARS, those long-range rockets. I think the supply of Western weapons has made a difference, but they haven't come in the quantities and at the speed with which the Ukrainians want. But I think that NATO countries, a number of them, realise that if Ukraine is going to carry out, conduct an offensive and to stop a Russian offensive, that they will need more weapons. I think the likelihood is that there will be Western main battle tanks, which will be the most advanced tanks that the Ukrainians have, coming from the West. But I think initially it'll be in relatively few numbers.
Jonathan Beale. Ethiopia's rebel Oromo Liberation Army says it carried out an attack on a prison the authorities say led to the freeing of 480 inmates. At least five police officers were killed. Catherine Buerhunger reports.
Mobile phone footage, which circulated after the prison break, shows a chaotic scene at night. The BBC has not been able to independently verify the video, but armed fighters wearing military uniform are seen walking around as inmates quickly gather their belongings. The voice of a man then congratulates the prisoners on being released by the Oromo Liberation Army. Fighting in Oromia has increased in the last few months, raising concerns about further instability in Ethiopia, despite a peace deal being signed to end the two-year conflict in Tigray.
Catherine Buerhunger. Next to Nigeria, and the country is experiencing a severe shortage of medical practitioners. Nigeria's doctors' union recently raised the alarm as a significant number of its dwindling membership looks to move abroad. The BBC's Baratu Ibrahim visited a public facility in the northwest of the country, which is struggling to cope as staff leave.
The Ahmed Bello University Teaching Hospital is publicly funded and treats at least 2,000 patients a day. Some of them have travelled long distances to get here.
I'm from Kaduna, so sometime going back, I will have to pass the night or go very late.
People come here from morning until 4 or 5 in the evening. I have got prostate cancer, and I would prefer to come and go in an hour or so. But no, you come here and meet over 100 patients, and there is only 3 doctors caring for them.
The waiting area is packed. The doctors say they are overwhelmed. Professor Obiako is a consultant neurologist.
We have an average of about 40 patients in the ward. We are only 2 of us as neurologists in this hospital. And the residents that are supposed to join us are not joining us, they are all leaving.
So why are these doctors leaving? The National Medical Association, which is the country's doctors' union, has blamed this on poor pay and a frustratingly slow bureaucratic process in the employment and replacement of health workers. Dr. Karimatu Hussain left the country to practice in the UK.
This is a very common problem. We all write our exams and then we start waiting for placements, which in the long run never comes. They do not create enough spaces for the training. There's also the pay. What we're being paid is not significant at all. As a doctor, I can barely afford to rent a place in Lagos.
Data I gathered from the Medical and Dental Council of Nigeria, MDCN, the body which regulates medical practice in the country, that there are just 425 specialists in active practice in the entire Northwest region. This area is home to about 50 million people, nearly a quarter of the country's population. It is in this region that the Ahmed Bello University Teaching Hospital is located. Of the 54,000 licensed doctors remaining in the country, only 18 of them are specialists, like neurosurgeons, for instance. In July last year, the General Medical Council recorded about 200 Nigerian doctors having been given licenses to practice in the UK. And only recently, the Nigerian Doctors' Union raised an alarm, suggesting at least 4,000 of its members could be preparing to leave the country to practice abroad. Now, according to a 2020 report by the British Medical Journal, there is already an estimated shortage of 2.8 million physicians worldwide, and the impact of that shortfall is felt mostly in low- and middle-income countries like Nigeria. Now, the question that many are asking is it fair for developed countries to employ doctors from countries whose own healthcare systems are nearing breaking point?
That report by Baratu Ibrahim in Nigeria. A woman in Canada has been ordered to pay damages to her former employer for so-called time theft. Carly Bess, who'd been working from home as an accountant, took her employer to a tribunal, arguing that she'd been wrongfully sacked. But the tables were turned on her when the tribunal found that tracking software proved that she'd been claiming for hours when she hadn't worked. Richard Hamilton told us more.
Carly Bess, she worked for a firm called Reach, and she felt she'd been unfairly dismissed. So she tried to sue the company for the equivalent of $3,500. But in court, it emerged that Reach, the company, had installed this software called TimeCamp on her laptop. This was after finding that her work was both over budget and not on time. And the company said she'd wasted 50 hours on non-work-related tasks. And it said that they'd seen irregularities between her timesheets and what was actually logged on this software. Now, at the tribunal, in her defence, she said she'd actually printed off hard copies, so she wasn't always at her laptop. She was studying these documents away from her computer. But the company didn't buy that, and they said the software is also linked to the printer, and there wasn't any, or there was very little, printing activity. And she also claimed that this software couldn't tell the difference between her work and doing other things on laptops, like watching Netflix. But apparently the software is much cleverer than she thought, and it can distinguish between those two activities. So she lost the case, and she was ordered to pay about $1,800 US for the missing time. That's for work that she'd been paid for but hadn't actually done.
So this tracking software sounds very sophisticated. With more and more people working from home, is it becoming more common?
That's right. As you say, especially since the pandemic, there's been a rise in working from home, or at least hybrid working. And basically, the short answer is yes, it has become more common. And there was a survey in the US in 2021 of 1,250 employers. This survey found that 60% of those companies that used remote employees were actually using work monitoring software. And then almost 9 out of 10 of these companies said that at some point they had fired people after using this software. So it seems a little bit sort of sinister, a bit sort of Big Brother surveillance type of thing. But on the other hand, you could argue that it prevents workers abusing this working from home scenario and slipping off to the gym or the pub or worse. But perhaps it's less common over here. But it's in North America certainly being seen as the new normal.
Richard Hamilton. Still to come.
Of Indian heritage, Frene Jinwala, like all non-white people, faced discrimination in apartheid South Africa. She joined the African National Congress but was forced into exile when it was banned in 1960.
We look back at the life of the anti-apartheid activist Frene Jinwala, who's died at the age of 90. Here in the UK, the Manchester City footballer Benjamin Mendy has been found not guilty of 6 charges of rape and 1 of sexual assault after a 5-month trial. The jury was unable to reach a verdict on 2 other charges, meaning the football star will face a retrial for those allegations later this year. Rowan Bridge reports.
Benjamin Mendy covered his face with both hands as the not guilty verdicts were read out in court. In a statement via his solicitor, he thanked the jury and said he was delighted to be acquitted. The prosecution alleged the 28-year-old was a predator who turned the pursuit of women for sex into a game. But his lawyers argued the claims were riddled with inconsistencies and flaws. Benjamin Mendy always insisted any sexual contact with the complainants had been consensual. He still faces a retrial at the end of June on 1 count of rape and 1 of attempted rape. He said he was looking forward to clearing his name on those remaining charges. When Benjamin Mendy signed for Manchester City in 2017 for £52 million, he was, at the time, the most expensive defender in football history. The following year, he won the World Cup with France. The club suspended him in August 2021 after he was charged with rape, and he hasn't been paid for over a year. Manchester City said they weren't able to comment on the outcome of this trial because of the outstanding legal issues.
Rowan Bridge. Europe has inaugurated its first mainland spaceport capable of launching vertical takeoff rockets in Sweden. This comes just days after a failed UK satellite launch and as Europe is looking to accelerate its own space programme. The inauguration of the Esrange Space Centre in the Arctic Circle was attended by the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen.
It's a big moment. It's a big moment for Europe. It's a big moment for Europe's space industry. The first orbital launch site on European mainland. This spaceport offers an independent European gateway to space. It is exactly the infrastructure we need, not only to continue to innovate, but also to further explore the final frontier.
My colleague Tim Franks spoke to Stefan Gardfjord, CEO of the Swedish Space Corporation, which founded the Esrange Space Centre, who was also at the inauguration. So when does he expect rockets to be launched with their satellite payloads?
First of all, this is already an operational spaceport, so there are a lot of operational activities with testing of engines and stages and so forth every day, and now also starting basically right now also of reusable rockets. But the actual launch into orbit, we plan to happen early 2024.
And just to be clear, the significance of this, of a vertical takeoff, is what? Is it just, does it mean that you can get more satellites of a different natures into space?
Well, I would say that there are pros and cons with vertical versus horizontal. Vertical is obviously the proven, established way of launching satellites into space. But I can certainly see applications whereby a horizontal launch may be even more suitable for certain satellites to certain orbits for certain certain applications. So it is a well-proven and sort of dependable way of launching satellites. And we have chosen the traditional vertical launch concept.
And I guess you would be the first to say, look, you know, it is proven, but none of this is easy. I mean, we saw just earlier this week an attempt at, as you put it, at a horizontal launch, which was off a modified 747 airliner off the south coast of England, which didn't work. This is still tough science, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough science, and I have to say that I really feel with the team that has been working so hard to make this first Virgin orbit launch out of UK the other week, and it looked like it was going to be successful, and finally it wasn't. And being in the industry, we know that that's part of the game, and I think it's reasonable to assume that you need a couple of attempts before you really tune things in. So that was sad, but it also goes to show that it is you know, truly rocket science, and a lot of really skilled engineers really get their act together, and that's the way it is.
Stefan Gardfjord, CEO of the Swedish Space Corporation. The sportswear company Adidas has lost a court case in the US to try to stop a fashion designer using a pattern incorporating four stripes. Its lawyers argued that the design used by the luxury brand Thom Browne was too similar to its own three-stripe trademark. But a jury in New York rejected the claim. Here's our business reporter, Noor Nanji.
It was a war over stripes, three as often seen on Adidas designs versus four used by the designer Thom Browne. Adidas said its trademark had been infringed and it wanted $8 million in damages. Thom Browne's lawyer said that stripes were a common design and that the two brands served different customers. They also pointed out that three stripes were not the same as four. A jury in New York sided with Thom Browne. Adidas said it was disappointed but would continue to enforce its intellectual property. This is not the first time the two sides have sparred. Back in 2007, Adidas objected to Thom Browne's use of a three-stripe design on its jackets. The designer agreed to stop using it and added the fourth stripe.
Noor Nanji, an Iranian chess referee has been barred from overseeing matches after she wore a T-shirt supporting women's rights at a tournament in Iceland. Mike Thompson reports.
Shohrat Bayat had fled Iran 3 years ago after breaching the country's strict dress code by failing to wear a hijab at a chess tournament. She arrived at the Iceland competition wearing a T-shirt bearing the slogan Women, Life, Freedom in support of anti-government protests in Iran. Told by the International Chess Federation's president, Arkady Dvorkovich, a former Russian deputy prime minister, to remove the shirt, she complied, only to return wearing a yellow suit and blue blouse, the colours of the Ukrainian flag.
Mike Thompson. The anti-apartheid activist Frene Ginwala, who became the founding speaker of South Africa's first democratically elected parliament, has died at the age of 90. Will Ross reports.
Of Indian heritage, Frene Ginwala, like all non-white people, faced discrimination in apartheid South Africa. She joined the African National Congress but was forced into exile when it was banned in 1960. Frene Ginwala spent decades in Tanzania, Zambia, Mozambique and the UK, drawing international attention to the abuses going on in her country. Her work was part of the pressure that helped force the political changes that eventually saw Nelson Mandela elected as president in 1994. South Africans remember Frene Ginwala as the well-respected first Speaker of Parliament who fought tirelessly for human rights, including gender equality. She once said African women stood on the lowest rung of the ladder of oppression.
Will Ross. For many people, the taste of chocolate is irresistible, but new research suggests it's the feel of it in our mouths that makes it so appealing. Using a synthetic tongue, academics at the University of Leeds here in England decoded the physical process that takes place when a person eats chocolate. They hope their findings could lead to the development of chocolate that has the same smooth and silky texture, but is healthier to eat. Robin Brandt has been getting his teeth into the story.
You peel back the wrapper, maybe you breathe in the aroma. Then you take a bite. You get your chocolate hit. But there's more to the sensory experience. The researchers were interested in the texture of chocolate as it enters the mouth, how it's broken down into an emulsion-like state, and, crucially, if that sensation can be maintained with less fat. They think that fat has a crucial role to play, instantly releasing a film that coats the inside of the mouth as soon as chocolate hits the tongue. Using a custom-made 3D surface that mimicked the human tongue, they analysed each stage of the process. Professor Amwisha Sukha was part of the research team.
We were trying to understand how chocolate works at each and every step. So once you start eating, so it licks against the tongue, then it mixes with saliva, then it melts, then it forms a bolus, and so on. So at each step, what really matters?
Their conclusion was that fat deeper within the chocolate is less important for that emulsifying sensation you get after that first bite. So a layer of fat only on the exterior of your chocolate bar could suffice. The hope now is that manufacturers might be able to reduce fat content specifically inside their products, but still hang on to that feel-good hit.
Robin Brandt. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, here's a quick request from Oliver Conway.
We need some help putting together a special edition of the Global News podcast marking 3 years since the UK left the European Union. Has Brexit been a triumph or a disaster for global Britain, or something in between? We'd like to know what people around the world think of the UK now it's outside the EU. So please send in your thoughts, questions or comments to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And if you could include a voice note recording, then we'll try to get a response from our Brexit experts, Rob Watson, Katya Adler and Darshini David. Thank you.
And you can also use that address if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered. This edition was mixed by Mike Adley. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
The BBC World Service has a world of podcasts just waiting to be discovered. Hi, I'm Namu Lanta. And season one of my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is available in full now. It's a handbook to life, written for daughters everywhere.
My darling daughter, you're so much more than the colour of your skin, the features of your face and body, the social class you come from, and who you marry. Those do not define you.
For Tales of the Unexpected, the Lives Less Ordinary podcast lays bare remarkable personal stories from around the world.
I had this secret.
And I just felt the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
I started having a strength in me.
Or to explore the stories behind the medals, the On the Podium podcast has some of the world's top athletes sharing their journeys to success.
How can I use this pain and this energy?
I think that breaking down stereotypes is so important.
That is a significant moment when you first win a medal at Olympic Games.
Whatever you're looking for in a podcast, the BBC World Service has something for you.
And it all gels together beautifully.
We're ready to go. We're ready to have fun. We're ready to party.
You can catch up with Dear Daughter, Lives Less Ordinary, and On the Podium now by searching for them wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Save up to 65% during the Back to Business sale at HP.com through January 14th. Click the link or call 1-800-608-MY-HP. Use promo code HPBusiness17 to save an extra 17% on business products. Exclusions apply.